Welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, special guest host Dr. Johnny Rees, and powered by Ultimate Performance, the world's premier personal training experience that delivers maximum results in minimum time. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, we speak to the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. So I am here today with Coach Joe DeFranco. Joe D, thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. We discussed before we got started here, this podcast, we were worried it was cursed for a while. This is like round four that we tried getting this thing going. I lost my voice for a couple weeks and then had a problem logging on from my computer. So now this is round four, and hopefully it will be worth the wait.
I'm sure it will be, Joe. I'm really grateful to you, and I've been looking forward to this for a long time. So I guess if we could just kind of kick off by, if you could tell me a little bit about your background, because I think your kind of personal background is one of the ways, or one of the things that helps you be so effective as a coach. So start off by kicking off there.
Appreciate that. So yeah, my background is in football, American football. I was obsessed for whatever reason. I just took to it at a very early age. My parents told me at like 2-3 years old, I was kind of sitting in front of the TV, understanding the plays and what a touchdown was. And I'm, you know, diving on my couch and running into walls and stuff as a little kid, loving, just obsessing over football. Wanted to play it at like 4 or 5 years old, but it didn't start until 7 years old back then. Now they actually wait, they don't do full contact football. They make you start with flag at a younger age, which probably isn't a bad idea. But I started real full contact, full pads football at 7 years old. Loved it from the second I did it. I just kind of took to it. I humbly say I was pretty good. I was just kind of a natural at that sport. And just fast forwarding, had success in those little, you know, peewee Pop Warner years. And then as I started getting a little older, 6th, 7th grade, I wanted to get better at football. And my dad, who was a New Jersey State Trooper, but on the side, was always into strength training. He competed in powerlifting, arm wrestling. He was 3rd in the world in arm wrestling, New Jersey State champ 5 or 6 times. And he had his own gym. He was one of 3 owners that owned just like this hardcore hole-in-the-wall warehouse gym in Paterson, New Jersey, where it was a lot of police, fire, military, and just very blue-collar gym. Everyone had their own key. And so my dad was an owner of that. It didn't make him any money. It was like 10 bucks a month for you to join. But I begged him to start taking me to the gym. And finally, when I was going into 8th grade, that was the first summer, he took me to the gym with him. And if anyone saw my old Strong documentary, we have some clips.
I was going to say, yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, and him like training you super hard when you were pretty young, right?
Yes, he pushed me to the point where I say it in the documentary, and it's a true story, that the other guys used to come up to me if my dad was off on the other side of the gym, and they would whisper to me and ask if they wanted me to have them talk to my dad, because they thought he was pushing me too hard, and they were looking at it like it was child abuse or something. But I'm like telling these grown men, like, no, I begged him to bring me here. I love this stuff. And I mean, I just, you know, those newbie gains, right? The first year you start strength training, you just get, you know, more weight on the bar every single time you're going to the gym. You're doing more reps. You're seeing some muscle. And then that, coupled with me being obsessed with football and being pretty good at football, that next year playing, I actually got too big. I grew taller. and I wasn't able to play my natural position. They had a weight limit for running backs, and I was too big to be a running back, so I had to play tight end. But the cool thing was that being a tight end, anyone who knows the sport, you block more, you get to catch the ball and score touchdowns and stuff too. But the strength that I built, I still have film of me in eighth grade. All it would take was one shot. There was no technique whatsoever. I would just hit the guy in front of me and they would fall flat on their ass every single time. Like, I was just pancaking dudes. And when I would catch the ball, nobody could tackle me. And it was just, this thing went off where now I became just as obsessed with training as I was with football. And then I ended up going to a very prestigious high school, which actually to this day, Bergen Catholic High School in New Jersey, great academic school, but also known for their sports. And at the time, like, football was the sport. They first in the state, you know, nationally ranked, the whole deal. So I literally go to that. It's an all boys Catholic school. I was a kid that wore, you know, sleeveless t-shirts and shorts year round. And now I'm going to this school where you got to wear a shirt and tie, and it's very proper. You know, our teachers were priests and brothers. But I did that because I'm like, I want to go to the best high school football program in the state. And I ended up going there and having a great career. We ended up being undefeated my junior and senior year, 22-0, nationally ranked, state champs. I was the captain, getting scholarship offers. And then literally I wake up senior year training camp over the summer. I wake up in the morning with severe nerve pain shooting down my leg. I just assume I tweaked something at practice or I got hit weird. And I just kind of was taking Advil, dealing with it. But I end up playing my entire senior year with this excruciating pain that once it started, it never went away. It wasn't like I could stretch and feel better or get a massage. It just was always there, like a 9 out of 10 pain of just nerve shooting down my leg. And obviously it affected my play, but I was a very quiet kid. I sucked it up. I still had 1,000 yards rushing my senior year, 22 touchdowns. But you could tell, like, people who know football, you could see I was operating at like 50% and still had a great season, but not like the Division I dominant season that I was hoping and should have and would have had, I think, if I was healthy. And very long story short, I've already made it long enough, but we finally find out after 5 years, I ended up having back surgery. They misdiagnosed me 50 to 100 times. They told me different things and nothing ever worked. Painkillers, drugging me up at 17, 18 years old. And then it finally turns out 5 years. Now I'm a senior in college. I end up going to a small Division III school because a lot of the scholarships were taken away because I didn't have that great of a senior. Again, I had a very good senior year, but not big time D1 level stuff. I end up going to a Division III school thinking, once I get this back thing taken care of, I'll transfer and go to a big school. It never gets taken care of. I try to play for a year. I play, but I'm in excruciating pain. And then the next 4 years are just me going to doctors, going to specialists every week. Literally, I'm having shots, I'm having procedures, I'm having surgery, waking up, the surgery didn't work. They cut me through my stomach to take a biopsy of my sacrum. It still didn't find anything. And then one day during a procedure, I'm getting a CAT scan and it showed like the right picture, the right slice of the bone, because it kind of shows the pictures in pieces and slices you could see inside the bone on some of these higher end CAT scan machines. And it shows I had a tumor growing inside my sacrum and it was basically breaking the bone. The bone fractured. The bone was what was hitting the nerve. That's why I had the nerve pain. But all the classic like disc rehab stuff and, you know, doctors tell me to do more planks and shit like that, none of that worked because I had a literal tumor growing in my spine and then, or my sacrum. And then once they removed that, it did take the nerve pain away, but I was stuck with nerve damage from the first surgery. I had injections where they numbed nerves in my legs just to kill the pain. So then I still to this day have no feeling in my right thigh and nerve pain shooting down my left leg. It's just a mess. But obviously that was the end of the football career, and which was devastating because I always, even though I wasn't playing, I always had that bit of hope. We're going to get this taken care of. I'm going to play and I'm going to go on to be in the NFL. And next thing you know, they don't discover this tumor and you know, get rid of it until I'm a senior in college. And that was devastating. And I fell into a deep depression, like crying myself to sleep each night, literally. But what saved me was my passion for training during the entire time I'm not playing football and I'm going through all these procedures. I'm studying exercise physiology in school. I'm barely getting by all my other classes, but I'm getting straight A's in exercise phys and anatomy because I'm equating it to working out in the gym. And so I'm enjoying my major subjects, the exercise science stuff. I had like a 3.9 out of a 4.0 in my major. And then everything else was like just enough to get by and graduate. I'm not going to lie, total meathead. But that's what it mentally got me through. I said, you know what? I'm going to be the best personal trainer. And I'm just going to study everything about anatomy and biomechanics and just training, personal training. And I want to help other athletes, whether it's football or another sport, achieve their goals and their dreams, the things I wasn't able to accomplish. Maybe I could find some happiness and joy in helping other high school kids get a scholarship or make the team or college kids get to the NFL. And that's what I focused literally all my attention on. Tunnel vision, obsession, whatever you want to call it. It was all in on that. And then when I graduated, I got an internship at the Parisi Speed School, which at the time was the only facility that was like pretty much had a program exclusively for athletes. So I got an internship there and very quickly, you know, showed that I was obsessed with this stuff and kind of worked my way up the food chain to become, you know, top one or two guys in that company. And I was there for 5 years. Training athletes and gaining experience before then opening up my own gym.
And as you said, I think that highlights several kind of key factors there. One is this ability to have this single-minded focus to, you know, first it was as an athlete yourself, as a player yourself, then on, you know, learning everything you possibly could to help others and to kind of put that, maybe help them get to places that you couldn't because of the injury, essentially.
So exactly.
We fast forward a little bit. So you're at the top of Parisi Speed School now. Then comes the 500-square-foot storage closet, right? Then comes the opening to the Industrial Strength Show, the kind of where you open up your own facility, essentially, right? I call it a facility. I mean, that's pretty small, but
yeah. I guess, me too. I guess it wasn't truly my own facility, but I call it that. It was. So I had 5 years, experience under my belt at the Parisi Speed School, which was great. I had a great 5 years there, learned a ton, gained a ton of experience, had some disagreements towards the end. It happens, no hard feelings, but I ended up wanting to move on, do something on my own. But, you know, anyone in the personal training industry, you know, now everyone tries to glamorize it and make it look like you barely work and you're on a beach making millions of dollars. I was working my ass off and I was far from rich. Let's put it that way. I didn't have much money saved up. So I wanted to open up my own business and my own gym, but I don't have, you know, I have enough money to pay my rent at that time and pay for my truck and, you know, put food on the table, but I didn't have a lot saved at that point. So I couldn't open up something big and elaborate. I had to do something that was very manageable. And what that was the health club that I had trained at when I was in college. It was called Odyssey Athletic Center. Cool, you know, normal health club gym. I had gotten to be pretty friendly with the owner because, again, being a meathead, like every second I was home, I was at the gym when I was in college. So the gym that I used to train at when I was in college, and I would come home for the summer, for the weekend, I had gotten to know the owner of that gym. So when I was looking to open up my own gym and I really didn't have a lot of money or resources, I went to him, and originally I was just going to see if I could kind of run my own personal training business out of his gym. But then he said, hey, I might have something better for you. I know you kind of have a specialized style of training, and it's different than what we're doing with just the general pop clients here in this gym. Let me show you this back room, which I never even knew was there when I trained at the health club. There was all the way downstairs in the back corner, it was literally a storage closet where he had old broken equipment and some office supplies. There was literally cobwebs in the storage closet. And he showed it to me. He goes, what do you think? I know it's not much. It's not too big, but I'll rent you out this storage closet. You could turn it into like your own little studio. And to me, at that point, I just thought that was the greatest thing ever. Again, it was only 500 square feet, but I saw, you know, magic in that place. I go, done deal. And then like the next day, we started cleaning it out. I slapped some black paint on the walls. I maxed out a credit card. I ordered 3 pieces of equipment, a squat rack, a reverse hyper and a glute ham raise, a barbell, some, you know, old weights. And that was the start of the, you know, DeFranco's Training Systems. I created an LLC and made it a real business. But my first quote unquote gym was a 500 square foot storage closet. And I'll tell you what, I think it's another lesson that's good for trainers and aspiring trainers to hear is it's not about the size of your facility. It's not about the fancy equipment. I literally was training people out of a closet with 3 pieces of equipment. And I had 5 years of reputation, a very good reputation that I built working somewhere else. So I didn't go in there, you know, cold. People knew who I was in the area. And when they heard I had my own spot, I had clients in there day one coming and signing up with me. And then it wasn't long after that. A few months after I started training some high school kids, next thing you know, some college kids, friends of the high school kids, one guy from the New York Giants, then he loves it. He brings a friend. At one point, I had 11 pro football players from the New York Giants, two Major League Baseball players, and one kid that ended up making it in the WWE, all training in a 500 square foot storage closet. So anyone who tells you need a big fancy facility or you need investors and millions of dollars to make it in this industry, complete bullshit. It's about the service that you provide and the results that you get, and you could do that anywhere.
It's amazing. And as you said, that reputation that you built out of the 500 square foot storage closet kind of built the foundation for everything that, you know, you've done today with the, you know, the podcast, the app. You know, it's really, as you said, it's amazing how it all kind of started, I guess. So
yeah, I think a good lesson. I know you said you have quite a few personal trainers and aspiring personal trainers in listening in your audience. I just had this literally yesterday on my own podcast, I answered a question similar to this that I think it's worth sharing for those listening here. A young aspiring trainer asked me how important it is to have multiple revenue streams because he follows me, which, you know, I'm always humbled when people say, I want to be like you. I want to do what you do someday. I really do appreciate that. And it is very humbling. But my advice to him was, while I appreciate that you are aspiring to do what I do, don't copy what I'm doing now. This kid was 24 years old. I'm 48. I have a lifetime on him, a literal lifetime on him. I said, the reason why you see those multiple revenue streams that you just mentioned, the app, we have our own, the CPPS certification, the podcast. Now we have the Iron Business Blueprint helping gym owners open up, giving them the steps and the systems to open up their own gym. The supplement line. I have all those things because I was really, really freaking good at one thing for a decade. I didn't focus on anything else but being the best damn personal trainer in the world. That was my goal. I want to be the best. I am going to over-deliver for every single client that walks through this door. I'm going to make up for the fact that I'm training people in a storage closet. I'm going to make up for the lack of equipment. I'm going to make up for the lack of space with results and an amazing client experience every single time. And because I did that very well for a decade plus, then these other opportunities came up where people said, oh, I'd love to learn your system. Boom, the certification develops out of that. Clients that are potential clients that say, oh, I'd love to train with you, but I live in Florida. I live in California. I live in Australia. Now we have the app. You can train with us via an online app. Like all those, these demands were created that opened up these other revenue streams because I focused on one thing to start. If I would have started in 2003 and tried to have a personal training business, an app, a certification, we would not be talking right now. You wouldn't know who I am because I would have went out of business in a year. So I know we got sidetracked a little bit, but I think that's a valuable lesson for young trainers. Focus on one thing. Be great at that one thing. That make the training, the personal training, the foundation, and then watch after 5+ years what happens. You're going to get other opportunities. But if you try to do it all at once, you're going to end up getting no opportunities because you're going to spread yourself too thin and you're going to have 4 or 5 mediocre, businesses and below average businesses and revenue streams. And who wants that?
And I think that's particularly important to remember in this age of like social media and all that sort of stuff, that you spent the hours in the trenches. You spent the hours building the reputation, training the athletes every day. I think that's really important for people to kind of remember.
Absolutely. If you want, listen, you can do very well and make a great living as an online trainer or have a fitness app. Obviously, you could reach, it's unlimited the amount of people you could reach, right? I could only train so many people in person in New Jersey each day. I don't care how good I am. There's 24 hours in a day. I'm only one person. You could only spread yourself so thin. But with online training, with these apps now, you could reach and help so many more people. But if you want to do that, if I was in charge of the fitness industry, I would make it mandatory 5 years. You have to train real people in person and be good at, like, get results with them, not just put the time in, because you could do something for very long. And if you do it kind of half-ass, still suck at it. I want you to do it for 5 years and obsess over it and get great at it. Now you could be a better online trainer. But if you just start as an online trainer with no real world in-person experience, I'm sorry, you're doing people a disservice. You're stealing their money.
Totally. And you built the demand for the scale before you tried to scale it, right? You already had and I think it's very persuasive that you had people coming to you. You weren't out there trying to like push it. They came to you first, right?
100%. Like over-credentialize yourself and then put out your first product. I'm so glad you brought that up because I probably get too much credit. Like people will say, oh, look what you've grown your business. You're a great businessman. I don't think I'm great at business at all. I still have learned some things? Absolutely. But all the things I mentioned, the app, the cert, the Iron Business Blueprint, the supplements, I came up with none of them. And that's the truth. I'm not just making up a story. Those came to me. There was a huge demand for my training, right? And everyone wanted to come and train with me. But again, not everyone lives in New Jersey. Not everyone could get here. So the demand was so high, I had no choice. We have to figure out a way to help these people, you know, still get the DeFranco-like results, but in their own state, in their own country, at their own gym. Same. And then the trainers were coming to me, and not just one or two, like every day for months and years on end. I want to learn your system. Well, how do you train people? How did you learn this? I have a degree. I went to college, but they don't really teach the practical application. And that's what created the CPPS certification. Smitty and I got together and we said, let's share a system of trainers. There's clearly a need for it. They want it, right? When I made I had my shoulder surgery and I transformed, rebuilt 2.0. And before that, I did my Operation Rebuild Joe D. For those who've been following my content for a little bit longer, I used to be 235 pounds, overworked, you know, getting 3 hours of sleep a night. And I finally made a choice that I was going to get my own health and life back. Lost weight, got blood work done, got Dr. Tom Bellella, God rest his soul, RIP, you know, someone who changed my life. I still get choked up thinking about him, but he was the one who changed me diet-wise and got me, instead of pissing my money away on every supplement, bodybuilding supplement at the vitamin shop, he created a supplementation routine for me based on my deficiencies, on my blood work, which made a huge difference, which then got a bunch of people contacting me saying, I want to do the same thing. Hence, DeFranco's nutritional supplements becomes a thing. And I could go on and on about all the different revenue streams I have. That's how they were all created. You, like the people listening, brought them to my attention, created the demand. I listened. And then now I have six different revenue streams. But they weren't a mastermind idea of mine. I got great at one thing. And then it opened up opportunities for all those other things.
I think that's so persuasive. So I suppose you could summarize that with, you know, results before revenue, right? You make sure you get the results, get the quality before you try to scale up.
Absolutely. And with the another point, if we're kind of taking a minute to talk to the personal trainers out there and aspiring personal trainers, this is another big point I've been really trying to hammer home a lot more recently. The word is personal training. It's half personal, half training. You can't just have the training part. You can't just know anatomy and biomechanics and programming. That's going to get you half the results. It's the personal training business. We deal with people all day, every day. You have to have that personal side. If you're not comfortable speaking with people, talking to people, making conversation, you need to get comfortable with it. It's not one of those things I go, focus on your strengths and don't worry about your weaknesses. No, if you want to be in the personal training industry, you got two things you got to get good at. Being a great person, being a great communicator, having great interpersonal skills, and the training. And while they are 50-50, at 48 years old with almost 30 years experience in this industry, I would tell you the more important 50% is the personal side, because there are a lot more trainers out there with zero training knowledge, but they just have great personalities that have schedules that are packed. They have waiting lists, and all the nerd, you know, personal trainers with master's degrees in exercise physiology that are broke, you're all getting mad at that trainer down the street who doesn't know shit about training, but he's making more money in a month than you're making all year. Well, instead of being mad at that guy or that girl, learn something from them. Why do they have so many more clients than you? Maybe that's something you need to get better at. Now, imagine you have the personality and you're actually a respected, knowledgeable, qualified trainer. You have the anatomy, the biomechanics, the programming background. Now you're unstoppable and you will make a nice living in this industry. But you can't just have one or the other. You gotta put equal attention and time into both.
Yeah, as you said, it's all very well kind of having all the knowledge, but it's the ability to communicate that knowledge, right? And it's the ability to kind of get through to people so they actually know what you need them to do when, and everything, rather than having all the theoretical.
Absolutely. You need the practical application. I've had three, it might have been four, but three I could remember when I was hiring new trainers at my gym. On three separate occasions, I got resumes from people with PhDs in exercise science. And I remember, while that is very cool, you know, being a 29-year-old, you know, trainer, gym owner, and you see these grown men, adults with PhDs wanting to come work for you, like, while I was very humbled by that, and I'm not saying all PhDs have no personality, but just the ones that I bring that up because you would think, wow, you had three or four people with PhDs in exercise science that wanted to be a trainer at your gym, yet you never hired them. None of them ever got hired because when I spoke to them on the phone or I met them in person, none of them had a quarter of the practical experience that I wanted them to have, or just the personality. They were very, you know, just no personality, very monotone. They knew studies and they had knowledge in their head, but they just didn't know how to apply it. I'll never forget, one came in and I just said, oh, why don't you put them through a warm-up and then you could shadow me. I'll put them through the workout. And you want to talk about like a deer caught in the headlights? Guy, it's like he never trained an athlete or a human before. And on paper, his resume was as impressive. It was more impressive than mine, and way more impressive than mine. But I was like, oh, okay, this is why this dude is looking for a job at this point in his life. Instead of already being super successful, he's got the training side down, at least the knowledge in his head, but zero personality, zero practical application. And this is why he's broke and has no job.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great example. And I think probably the fact that you were an athlete, that really helped as well. Helps you kind of get through to athletes. You know what they're going through. You know what's going to work with them, what won't, you know, as well as having all that.
Absolutely. There's something that locker room atmosphere, team atmosphere, community, especially I played football, so it's a team sport. You need to rely on other people, right? I was a running back. If the offensive line sucks and they don't block anybody, I'm getting killed. It doesn't matter, you know, how good you are. So it does help with just being a little bit more of a people person, communicating. Because I was actually, a lot of people don't know, I grew up a shy. I barely spoke as a kid. I was very shy. I spoke when I was spoken to. Even to this day, outside of doing this stuff, being on podcasts, I love teaching and coaching. This is the one small area. I always say I know a lot about a little. Like, this is my world, what we're talking about right now. Outside of this, I don't really say much. I don't really like much. At Thanksgiving dinner, I'm not like the life of the party in the DeFranco household. I'm actually kind of quiet. So it wasn't easy. I bring that up just because that part did not come easy for me. That's why I emphasize it so much now to the trainers, because I was the shy guy. When I worked at the Parisi Speed School and I was training a lot of young kids, you know, kids, when they're in like that awkward stage, especially now, because none of them know how to communicate because they all just text and go on TikTok and they snap each other instead of physically talk with each other. They're on Snapchat. So I would be training like a group of 8, 12-year-olds and they were all just awkward. None of them would talk. They give you a little one word, yes, no answers. So I had to make myself learn how to become a better communicator. And that's when I quickly realized how important it, you know, the personal side was, because I spent half of those sessions figuring out how can I get these kids to come out of their shell. Forget about teaching a trap bar deadlift. Like, I need to get these kids out of their shell so they're a little more comfortable with this session. They could open up to me. They like coming here more. then I'll be able to accomplish what I really care about, which is helping them run faster, jump higher, pack on muscle, build that confidence. But I didn't start getting those results until I was able to talk with the kids. And a lot of times that meant me learning more about TikTok, figuring out what they were watching on YouTube, talking about Mr. Beast, you know, the latest Mr. Beast video. Like, I literally did that stuff just so I could have a conversation. And then you see these kids light up a little bit when you're talking about something that they want to talk about. You're not just acting like the typical 40-year-old guy that can't relate to them. That's when I started getting a lot more out of those young kids. And it had nothing to do with training. So I share that just to emphasize how important, again, the personal side is. And if you are kind of introverted and shy, you got to practice it, and you have to get better at it to be good in this industry and make a living in this industry.
And I think it says so much about you, the fact that you've kind of retained this blue collar work ethic, and you'll actually, you know, bother to find out what helps, you know, what makes these kids tick, what they find interesting, to get through to them. Because you could be like, oh, well, you know, I train Triple H, I train all these pros, you know, I don't have time to deal with this. But the fact that you do is, you know, I think that says a lot about you.
No, I appreciate it. But it's important. It's important. If you want to make it in this industry, it's 50% of the job, period. You know, that's it.
Totally. And I think that's so important and persuasive, coming from someone like you who does also have that kind of technical expertise, that technical ability to, you know, take half a second off your 40 yard or add, you know, 10 reps to your 225 test and all that sort of stuff. So we'll talk about the kind of actual health and fitness stuff in a second. But I think because we've started on this, I'd love to get a little bit more about kind of Joe D's life lessons. So I'm going to ask you something, and it kind of goes to what you've just been talking about a second ago. But you are very keen on making sure people will always return their shopping carts. Could you kind of tell me a little bit about why that is? Because I think it illustrates a broader life lesson.
So that came about to me. It's funny because it's kind of, there's like memes now on the internet. It's kind of become a more popular thing. But, and I know I'm not the first person to bring that up, but I certainly think I helped popularize it because there wasn't many people talking about it.
No, you popularized it for me for sure, and pretty much everybody I know. So,
That's cool. I'll take credit for that then. But so I just felt like this is, and most people go, oh, I still get hate in the comments where you get the people that are like, this is so stupid. What's the big deal? You're making too much of a big deal about this. Like, who gives a crap if someone puts their shopping cart away? And to me, that's exactly why I make a big deal. The people who make those comments on my Instagram, I say, you're the exact type of person I don't want to be friends with. I don't want you working for me. I would God never work for you, because that's your attitude towards something as quote unquote minuscule as returning your shopping cart. Why is something so small and insignificant a big deal? Just for that reason. You don't have to do it. It's not a law. You don't go to jail. You don't get in trouble. You don't get fined if you don't return your shopping cart. But it's the right thing to do. It shows you're not selfish. What does that have to do with someone else? They'll say, well, now the next person doesn't have the chance of that shopping cart rolling and hitting their car if wind blows, and their car gets dented from a shopping cart floating around the parking lot. Also, when they need the shopping cart, it's where it's supposed to be. They don't have to go hunting it down all along the parking lot. So it shows you're not selfish, for one. It shows you have integrity, right? Doing the things that, you know, when nobody's watching, doing those little things that you really don't have to do, but you do them anyway. So it shows that you have integrity. It shows you don't take shortcuts in life, right? That's another big one. It's easy just to be like, oh, I'll go get another one, or I just want to leave. That's big to me. People who don't take shortcuts. You're not a lazy bastard. Let's put it that way. You don't have to do it. And it's discipline. It's doing something that you don't always want to do or maybe have time to do, but you do it anyway. You know how many times I've been running late and I'm parked, you know, one of the last parking spots. I put all my groceries away. And it would just be so much quicker to get in my car and get the hell out of there. It's the discipline of saying, you know, I don't feel like doing this right now. I don't want to walk it back, but I'm going to do it because of all the things I just mentioned. It's the right thing to do. I respect other people. I'm not selfish. I have integrity, especially now. I talk about it a lot. So I mean, I could be in an empty parking lot, midnight, nobody in the world watching. I'm putting that shopping cart away because if there is that one person out there, I don't want to be the guy that doesn't do what I say. That means a lot to me. If I tell you I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. And it's why I was so upset when I had to cancel on you when I lost my voice, because in my brain it was, we had a schedule. I told him I was going to do his podcast. I gave him my word, and now I'm going back on it. And even that, yes, that was out of my control, but in my brain, it's shit. I'm not doing the thing that I said I was going to do, and that doesn't feel good to me. But that insignificant shopping cart thing, as you can see, means a lot more to me because of its insignificance. I think it just speaks volumes about the person that'll just take the time and put it away.
And as you said, how you do one small thing like that can be kind of indicative of how you do everything, right?
That's absolutely
sort of, it says more than it you'd think it would in that sort of isolated example.
How you do anything is how you do everything. That is a real thing. And again, just look at the people, everyone I know that's successful. I don't think it's a coincidence. They're people that put their shopping cart away. Click on the profiles of the people in the comments, post the meme about putting your shopping cart away, and then you'll get 3, 4, 5 people. Most of them will all say, yes, that's great, I agree. But you're going to get the couple that say, this is bullshit. You're making a big deal about this. This is nothing. Click on their profile, and then you see exactly what type of person is making those comments. And every time I just shake my head and I go, with your comment, all you are doing is proving my point.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I couldn't say it better. So I think that explains it really well. So we've talked a little bit about, or you've talked a little bit about kind of mistakes that you see people make. And switching gears a bit now, I was wondering if you could kind of give me an explanation or an observation of the mistakes that you see people making when training athletes, when trying to get them faster, more explosive. Appreciate that's quite a wide question, but the sort of 2 or 3 biggest mistakes you see.
Yeah, because, man, this could be its own podcast, but I'll tell you, when you say athletes and training more for performance, there's two that pop right to the top of my head first of 100 we could talk about. But the first two, I would say, one, this is like 1A and 1B for me, the exercise selection. So there's no magic exercise, right? There's a million different exercises we can choose to get stronger, faster, jump higher, whatever the goal is, you could name it. And there's a million and one ways to get to that goal. Just as an example, to improve your vertical jump, right? We know power is plane specific. So if you want to get better at improving your vertical jump, you want to incorporate more vertical type jumping, a box jump, a squat jump. In the weight room, if you're going to try to improve your rate of force development, squat pattern, hinge pattern, that vertical triple extension, upward explosion, right? Now, depending on your body type, your current level of strength, skill, mobility, that's going to determine what exercise best fits your body type and your goals. Some people swear by the squat being the king of all exercises, and some say it's the deadlift. They're both right. There's a reason people who are great at deadlifting generally have longer arms, bigger hands. Like, they have the right body type that they could set up properly, deadlift properly, and feel it in the right places. Their spine doesn't hurt the next day. They feel, you know, muscularly speaking, they're feeling it in the right places. They get stronger and they get a lot out of that exercise. Now, have that same person ask them how they like the bench press, just as an example. Most people who could deadlift a lot hate benching because their long arms and the anthropometry, if you will, the limb lengths and the body proportions that make you good at deadlifting generally make it a lot harder to bench press. The people that love the bench press have the short little T-Rex arms and the big barrel chests, right? And they're all about the bench. Usually they're more built for squatting too. Getting a little off track, but you get my point where we could choose. Do I care if you do a box jump or you jump on your stairs instead of a box, or you like power cleans and power snatches, but the other guy says, oh, I hate those. I kind of suck at them. I'd rather hold a pair of dumbbells and just do a squat jump for that vertical power. We're all right. We could all improve, in this example, our jumping ability doing the things I just mentioned, but you want to pick the right exercise for your body type and your current level of strength, mobility, and skill. So I think too many coaches, they're married to exercises where that should be the least of your concern. You got to figure out, you know, we know we have the foundational movement patterns, right? We have squat, hinge, lunge, upper body push, upper body pull, and some kind of a carry. Those patterns pretty much are what's going to make up any program: strength, hypertrophy, training for power. Then we mix and match those movement patterns. But the specific exercises you choose is going to depend on the specific athlete or client you're training. So don't get so married to an exercise. There's a million and one choices. It's more about the adaptation is what is the most important. You got to make sure you're doing the right, like if you're really strong and you're trying to improve your vertical jump, the adaptation you're looking to develop is more speed, strength, or rate of force development. You need more plyos and reactivity, more explosive training than just heavy, slow lifting. So as long as you have that down, and now again, just using the example of a vertical jump, and then you're training that speed in the vertical plane, choose what you want. It doesn't matter. But most coaches do the opposite. They're arguing over what's better, a hang clean or a snatch. And it's like, that's the least important part of this conversation. So that would be number one. And then number two, with athletes looking to get more explosive, more powerful, I think the most overlooked training variable is rest, right? We're all, social media is about train harder, no days off, beast mode. But if you want to run faster, you want to jump higher, you want to physically improve those capacities, we need speed and we need quality of movement. We shouldn't be, you know, training to failure and have a big pump and think, oh my God, my legs are burning, they're blown up there, I got such a pump from those squat jumps. If you have a burn or a pump or excessive fatigue from your jump training or your power training, you're doing it all wrong. You want quality, speed, power, and then rest. And we're resting so we can maintain that level of speed and power. We want those higher outputs, right? That's why Louis Simmons popularized the dynamic effort method. Instead of doing three sets of 10 with a weight, right? Take that same weight and flip-flop it, do 10 sets of three. At the end of the day, it's the same sets, it's the same total volume, right? We just inverse the sets and reps. But what's the difference if you do 135 for 10, three sets of 10, and I do 10 sets of three, if we looked at my power output each rep, I'd have 30 fast, explosive, quality reps. That's going to improve my power, as opposed to your three sets of 10, reps number 8, 9, and 10, they might be a little slower, more grinders. That's fine for hypertrophy. You're gonna get a better burn. You're going to get a better pump. But me, if I'm trying to train for power, I'm going to have more energy when I'm done. I'm going to almost feel like I drank a cup of coffee, whether we're squatting, benching, whatever. But power output, my average power output for all 30 reps is going to be way more than yours. And the biggest thing was, we just broke those reps up with some rest in between, so I had higher outputs for all those reps. And not enough trainers and coaches equate for that. They're just trying to make their clients, their athletes, tired and sweaty. And that's the last thing you want to do when training for speed or power.
As you said, yeah, I think that highlights a couple of really important points there. So the first one, I guess, would be there are no mandatory exercises, right? Just mandatory movement patterns. And I think to give another kind of practical example that really helped me that I got from you was, I was never that good at cleans or clean pulls, but a trap bar deadlift jump could do that really well. So it's accomplishing essentially the same thing, and I could actually produce more power doing that because I wasn't limited by the fact that my technique was never that good on the next level.
Absolutely. I prefer, again, if we're just talking about athletes looking to generally improve their power output, I want lower skill, higher output exercises. I want something I could teach you today, and within 5 minutes, you've pretty much mastered the pattern. Now we could actually start training that quality and your body adapting. We get a stimulus, your body starts to adapt, and you're starting to get some actual quality training in day one, as opposed to, oh, we're going to learn how to snatch with a broomstick for a week and then the empty bar. And listen, with the Olympic lifts, a lot of people still will ask me why you've trained so many athletes, but I rarely, if ever, see Olympic lifts in your programming. It's because a lot of my athletes, especially early on, I would get them, I'd have 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks. I need to get results fast. I want a training effect today. So do I want to, again, I have no problem with a power clean, a snatch. I think it's, if you could do it and do it well, it's one of the most impressive feats of strength there are. Speed, strength, power, whatever you want to call it. Super impressive. I love it. But I just know someone who trains football players, baseball players, wrestlers, generally speaking, they suck at those exercises. I tried them early in my career. The reason why they didn't stay in a lot of the programming is because it just took too long for them to get good enough at them to start getting some kind of, you know, a training effect from them.
Totally. And I think that highlights another couple of really important points that you've made. But it's that learning that practical application and learning, you know, versus the study, what actually works with athletes. And second, there's a reason Olympic lifting is an Olympic sport in itself, right? It's technical. It's like ballet with a barbell. It's not just a plug and play type exercise, right? And these guys are athletes. They're football players. They're basketball players. They're not Olympic lifters, first and foremost, right?
You're asking them to learn a whole nother sport. Imagine having an Olympic weightlifter. You have 4 years to train them for the Olympics, and you take 3 years teaching them how to play football. It's like, this has no carry. You know, what are we doing here? You're doing the same. You're taking a football player and saying, learn this sport, this Olympic sport that people train for 4, 8, 12 years for, and they'll tell you they don't feel like they mastered the lift yet, right? And we're having a football player who strength trains 45 minutes, 2-3 times a week after practice, trying to teach them this exercise and you not get any kind of adaptations from that other than I've had guys come to me with broken wrists, hurt back, herniated discs, all from trying to clean too heavy and having poor technique, when they could have grabbed a pair of dumbbells and jumped, to your point, as high as they can. Grab a trap bar, jump as high as you can. Do some band jumps. Do some box jumps. There's so med ball throws. I mean, there's so many less technical, higher output or equally high output exercises that are low risk, high reward. I'm taking them every time.
Yeah. And when you flip it around like that, it really serves to make a persuasive point, right? It really makes a lot of sense. So another thing, and I'm conscious of time, that you kind of touched on there is, so certain exercises will be, unless you're really good at doing them, will be harder on the body, right? If you've done years of cleans and you miss a clean or whatever, it's going to have an impact on your wrists, on your elbows, on your shoulders, that sort of thing. So I'd like to kind of change gears a little bit. And I remember not that long ago, Rebuilt 2.0, right? You had a pretty major shoulder surgery and you kind of had to rebuild yourself from that position, right? So I guess a couple of questions there. One would be recovery from injury and the strategies, the techniques that you use to recover from that injury and build back stronger. And two, longevity and how to kind of, you know, I'm mid-30s now. We'll have a lot of guys mid-40s, for example. You want to be able to train, but the sort of big three, squat, bench, deadlift, may not be your best choice anymore, if indeed they were ever, right? But certainly, so I guess recovery from injury would be my first question. And then sort of how we can program training around longevity as opposed to, you know, doing any mandatory exercises that you mentioned earlier.
Absolutely. I think first off, you could do your best to prevent yourself from getting injured by, just to go back and reiterate, choose the right exercises for your body type, I think it is first and foremost, because I think that is what injures most people. One is, again, square peg in a round hole, right? Trying to fit a square peg in a round hole and you're just trying to jam this thing like, no, I'm going to make it fit. I don't care. That's when you start having issues. Like I've talked about my shoulder. I don't know if people know, if everyone knows or not. People ask, how did you have such a catastrophic shoulder issue? The labrum was torn, bicep tendon completely torn, supraspinatus tendon torn. And I also had the subscapularis was torn.
So all it was those right like, safety cuff, yeah.
Everything. Just check. But it wasn't one specific injury. It was just kind of over time, 30 plus years of lifting. Football certainly helped, contributed to it. But I had a slightly separated shoulder my freshman year in college, the 1 year I tried to play. And I'll never forget when I had the x-ray, the doctor told me, I was a freshman in college just studying anatomy and learning about this stuff, talked about the subacromial space, right? The space between the head of the humerus and the hard part on the top of your shoulder, your acromion, the little hook that comes off your scapula. You have space in there and the supraspinatus tendon and others run through that space. Certain people, just genetically how we're built, again, anthropometry, some have a bigger space. And those are the people that love to overhead press and they say, that feels great. For me, overhead pressing never felt great. Even perfect form, warm up, mobility. So thankfully, I stopped overhead pressing pretty early in my lifting career. I probably did it for 3 or 4 years. And then I cut it out. But I bring that up because I was just destined for a shoulder issue. My technique is pretty on point. If you see me train, I learned from the best. He was like a drill instructor. Your technique had to be perfect on everything. And so here I am, a guy who never skips my warm-up. I warm up properly. My technique is on point. I stretch. I do mobility. I do my rotator cuff exercises. Yet, I tear everything in my shoulder. Well, when you know the anatomy, just me moving creates impingement the way that I was built. And so it's amazing I actually made it as long as I did before all that stuff went. But I just think that's important to know, because if I'm someone who ignores that and just says, hey, every bodybuilding magazine says you want bolder shoulders, you got to overhead press, I would have had that surgery at 23 instead of 43 or 44, however old I was when I had it. So I was able to prolong it by listening to my body, choosing the right exercises. And I've gotten way smarter with that now than, you know, when I was younger. I'm not saying I did everything perfect, but even being a guy that was conscious, look, I still ended up, you know, having major shoulder surgery. So I just can't emphasize that enough. Listen to your body. If something hurts, don't do it. Pick another exercise. We just talked about, there's 101 different variations for each movement pattern. Pick something else, but also try to figure out, why did that one thing hurt? Is it something that I could get better at? Is it a technique issue? Is it a mobility issue? Is it a strength issue? Yes, try to improve that, but also know sometimes our body just isn't built for certain exercises, so choose something else. So that's more important than anything. If you do that, maybe you won't have to worry about rehabbing from injuries. If you do end up having an injury, the best advice I could give, to not spend all day on this, because this could obviously be a whole podcast in and of itself, but Kelly Starrett said this to me, because I think he had his hip, or I think he had his hip replaced, or his surgery was in weeks of my shoulder surgery, and we did a podcast together. And we were talking about, yeah, the, you know, supplementing with extra collagen and BPC-157 and extra vitamin C. And I was doing proteolytic enzymes, bromelain, supposed to help with reducing scar tissue, drinking a lot of water. Like, yes, all these things could help. But I remember Kelly said this, and it stuck with me. He said, just don't forget, the human body heals at the rate of a human body, or slower. You're not making it go any faster. We could optimize the healing process so we could heal at the rate of a human. But in my case, just say my supraspinatus tendon is completely torn. I don't care what I do. Now, let's say I have the surgery, I'm post-surgery. No matter what I do, what supplements I take, that ain't coming back and regenerating in 2 or 3 weeks, right? Like, there's a certain amount of time tendons will take to get back to their, you know, that full tensile strength, and you could start training, quote unquote, normally again. You can't rush that part. When they tell you you got to be in a sling for 6 weeks, it's going to be 6 weeks. The goal is to not have to keep it on for 7 or 8 or 9. I want to be right. I want to optimize and heal at the rate of a human. But just remember, you ain't doing it faster. So save yourself the agony of re-injuring something or having to have another surgery. Then you're really screwed. So the best advice I could give, I was obsessed with my rehab. I started rehab the day after surgery, literally the next day. And I did not stop. It was every single thing the doctor and my physical therapist told me to do. Didn't miss a day. And I attacked it like to the T. But so each day I rehabbed almost like I was in a hurry. Like, I got to get better. But long term, I had the patience. I wasn't rushing barbell benching or doing chin-ups or anything stupid. I worked very hard and like I was in a rush, but long-term, kind of macro-wise, I was very patient. And I think that's very important advice for people to know. Don't try to be a hero. Nobody gives a shit. Nobody would have cared if I would have been full strength a month earlier than I was. Truth be told, I made an amazing recovery, but I wasn't fully 100% back where I would say, okay, the surgery is fully healed now. 2 years it was. I was doing a lot at like the 6 month point. You're starting to train, at least mentally, you're feeling better. A year, I felt way better than I did before I had the surgery, but I still couldn't do a chin up. I couldn't even hang from a bar. I just didn't, It was probably more of a confidence thing, but I didn't feel good. Anyone who has Rebuild 2.0, you'll see I demoed every single exercise except I asked Calvin, the head coach at my gym, to demo the chin-ups because I still didn't feel comfortable doing them. So just to show you, but I looked great, you know, and I was doing a ton in the gym, but it took that long to get to the point. Now I'm doing full range chins with extra weight, but I didn't do anything. The old me would have done stupid shit to try to be a hero and a tough guy and be like, look at me, only 1 month post surgery and I did my first chin up. That's when you end up re-injuring yourself. I took a little bit longer, but knock on wood, I really let that heal. And now I'm able to do way more with that shoulder than I was before the surgery. So that's a big point. And just one more point I want to make with the injury thing, which I think is important. Remember, while, you know, part of me is kind of saying, hey, don't rush it. Work hard, but be a little conservative in that respect. But when I say conservative, again, I was working my ass off. There's always something you could do. It blows my mind when someone goes, oh, I can't go to the gym. I injured my shoulder. I hurt my wrist. I got to take this week off. Bullshit. You got three other limbs. Like, there's always something you could do. And there's research to back that. Besides my regular rehab with my shoulder, 2 days a week, I did legs and I trained my good side. You could see there's videos of me on Instagram, single arm dumbbell bench with my right arm at the time, lat pull downs, you know, rows. I was training the right side of my body. And there is some research to show that there is that contralateral effect, the crossover effect. When you train the good limb, the injured limb gets some strength and hypertrophy gains from that. At the very least, you know, I'm not saying you're going to get jacked on the injured side, but it certainly can and I would say does delay your strength loss, hypertrophy loss, because I did not lose as much muscle as I thought I was going to after the surgery. And I think a big, big contributor to that was the fact that I still trained the right side of my body throughout the entire process.
I think that's really useful to know. And also just to kind of remember that there's always something, as you said, there's always something you can do, even if it's very soon after the surgery, maybe not on the affected limb or the affected side, but there's always something you can do. You know, it's not an excuse to be like, oh, well, I won't train at all, right? I'll give up and I'll come off my nutrition and all that sort of stuff. That's probably the time to double down on everything else, right?
Absolutely. And that was the bit, you know, I really stepped up my game nutritionally. You know, I was eating better. Sleep was always one of the things I lacked. I'm kind of the classic type A overachiever. And even just having a schedule, I used to train Triple H and Stephanie McMahon at midnight. So there's a point in my life where I'd go to bed 4 a.m. not every day, but 4 days a week. I was going to bed 4 a.m. I had newborn twins. So they're waking me up an hour or two after I went to bed. So some of that was uncontrollable. But then when I was able to control it, I wasn't, you know, I took 2 weeks off of work after the surgery. And now there's no excuse. Like, you could get your rest. You could eat more just single ingredient whole foods, right? Your nutrition could be more, or your hydration could be more on point. Though cardio, I that's another thing I've changed. I do more just general walking every morning now. I walk, and 2 to 3 days a week, zone 2 cardio, keeping my heart rate in that zone for 30 to 45 up to 60 minutes, because that's something that I neglected. You know, as a younger meathead, it was just all about getting big, bigger, stronger. You mentioned I was, you know, 235 pounds, bloated out of my mind, where now, you know, I want to live a long, healthy life and be around for my kids for as long as possible. Me carrying 235 is not doing me any good. And it's pretty clear, like, you do any amount of research on longevity, and you will see everything leans towards being leaner, not carrying around a lot of extra mass. It's just not good. Like all the things we do to get big and jacked and strong and pack on muscle, yeah, while we increase the rate of our jackedness, it also increases the rate of cellular aging and, you know, inflammation. And there's a lot of bad things that come along with that. So while it is very important to pack on muscle and have muscle on your body as you age, but you don't want excessive amounts of any mass. You leaner is better for longevity. And cardio, you can't get all of your health benefits just from strength training. While I do think it is the single best form of exercise in the world, if you had to pick one, but we don't have to pick one and we shouldn't pick one. Your heart adapts differently when you do something like zone two cardio. You hear a lot of like pro bodybuilders that die young. You hear they have this real thick heart. Well, the zone two type cardio, you get the opposite adaptation. You get that stretching effect, which you don't get that from higher intensity strength training and the higher intensity intervals. So you need some of that longer duration, lower intensity, more aerobic training as you age, coupled with the strength and the nutrition to be, you know, strong and muscular, but lean. That's the big change I think I've made in my 40s. It's not just big and strong as possible. It's as strong and as lean as possible.
And as you said, like, it doesn't mean that you have to give up your strength goals, because one of the things I've noticed that you're really good at is pushing relative strength goals, right? So stuff like chins, stuff like weighted push-ups, all those sorts of things. You can still have that idea where you're trying to beat records and beat numbers, right? You don't have to give that up. I was wondering if you could kind of talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. As I've gotten older, that's like one of my kind of longevity. We have our a list of longevity laws, if you will, lifting laws of longevity, whatever you want to call it. And that's one of those. I now prioritize relative strength goals over absolute strength goals, which means how strong are you in relation to your body weight? So yeah, I still love to bench press. I'm still a meathead. I still just enjoy it. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if I see, you know, my bench press has gotten stronger, but I'm not able to do as many chin-ups, or my push-up capacity is getting worse, I know I've probably added some dead weight to my body, right?
And it keeps your nutrition in check, right? And your cardio in check, all that other stuff.
Yes, that's what I love about it. The relative strength, it's one thing. I love simple. I say, hey, prioritize your relative strength goals over absolute strength goals. So for a client that isn't as into this stuff as we are, they just say, okay, Joe says, I focus a little bit more on my push-ups and chin-ups as opposed to my bench squat and my deadlift. Okay, cool. Without me saying anything else, if they see, shit, I used to be able to do 10 chin-ups, now I can only do 6. What are they going to start? When they say, hey, Joe, how come I can't do as many chins? I'm going to be honest and be like, hey, you got about 5 pounds of fat around your midsection that you didn't have last year. Let's start there. And oh, really? Yeah, that's right. I did put on some pounds. So it just leads you into, okay, you want to get better at that one thing, relative strength? Well, we got to clean up the diet. So now we get that snowball effect. Hey, I don't love using cardio to lose weight, but it is helpful burning some extra calories. Just generally, you know, for your overall health, you might prioritize walking a little bit more, taking some more steps. So that's going to indirectly help, or directly even help, with things like chin-ups and push-ups. So with that one goal, now you start getting these habits and these changes that you're making in your lifestyle that have this snowball effect where you're doing everything right. So I still love training for something. That's why I'm glad you brought up the goals. So for me, just to give you an example, there's a million of these, but so I've become obsessed with, instead of being obsessed over like your bench press, which a couple years ago, I had this goal to bench double my body weight on my 42nd birthday. I did that that also, it was from that point where then like the shoulder started getting a little worse and worse because I was doing so much heavy lifting. And again, just with my shoulder structure, heavy barbell benching, even if my technique is on point, isn't great. And we know that. I went through the surgery, but push-ups don't cause me any pain. So now, instead of having 1RM bench press goals, the past 6 weeks, I've been doing the you know, the Sally challenge, the Sally push-up
Sally
challenge?
Sally, I'll tell you that. I do, yeah, the song, yeah.
So that was my first big goal after the shoulder surgery. I said, I want to complete the Sally push-up challenge. Every time they say bring Sally up, you do a push-up. When they say bring Sally down, you hold yourself in the down position of a push-up, like that low plank position. And that was a huge step. When my shoulder was healthy enough to do that, most people can't do that healthy with you know, no issues. So
three
that
plus
was,
minutes, right? It's a long time.
Three and a half minutes, 30 push-ups with ISO holds. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it's brutal. But once I'm able to do that, and I'll never say it's easy, but now I could do it every time, every Friday. So I'm actually doing it today after my next call when we get off. I progress that. So I went regular Sally challenge. Once I did that three or four times in a row and said, all right, I got that. Then I did seesaw push-up Sally challenge, where I put the barbell across the dumbbell and you got to stabilize, makes it a little bit harder. I did that. Then I completed that with a seesaw challenge with a 15-pound vest, which almost tore my pecs off the bone, but I was able to do that. And then last week, I was so proud. For the first time in my life, I did the Sally push-up challenge with ring push-ups with my feet elevated. That was one of the most brutal, challenging things I've ever done in my life. The stretched position in the rings at like the 3 minute mark is brutal. But I bring that up not to brag about my Sally push-up challenge prowess, but at 48 years old, post-surgery, not really able to lift as heavy as I once was. Like the meathead in me would say, oh, you're weaker than you used to be because I can't bench 425. But when I was able to bench 425, no way in hell was I able to do the Sally push-up challenge on freaking gymnastics rings. So I have a different strength now, one that is more conducive to health and longevity. So I focus on that when I go to the gym. I have chin-up goals, push-up goals, goblet squat with 50% of my body weight goals. You know, you drop weight, you could actually progress and hold a lighter dumbbell, right? Because now a lighter dumbbell could represent half of your body weight. And so I kind of trick myself into other ways of progressing other than just the only way to progress is to throw more weight on the bar. Yes, that is one, and it's awesome. I love throwing 5 more pounds on the bar, but as you get older, start challenging yourself in other ways. Progress by improving your chin-up reps. Do more reps instead of just more weight. Maybe do the same amount of reps, but slow down the eccentric. Or try to do the same set in reps, but take 20 seconds less rest in between sets. There's so many different ways to progress. You could progress an exercise by increasing the range of motion. I do that a lot with my lower body training because of with the back issues and my nerve damage. You know, heavy axial loading is not great for me in general, but say an exercise like a reverse lunge, instead of just always going heavier, 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 what I do is I elevate my front foot. I might elevate it on a 10-pound plate and then say, oh, let's see if I could do that same weight, but elevate my foot on a 4-inch box. Now I'm doing the same weight, but it's like 3 or 4 inches greater range of motion. That's huge progress.
Really, progressive overload, right? Yeah.
That's still progressive overload comes in many different forms and fashions. It's not just more weight to the bar. I could give you a dozen. I actually just rambled off 5 or 6. You use those as you get older, and you will have longevity in the lifting game, as opposed to if you just try to add more weight every single time you go to the gym, eventually you're going to end up injuring yourself.
Yeah, and as you said, otherwise, if it was as simple as that, everybody would be benching 1,000 pounds, right?
Absolutely.
Well, Joe, you've been really generous with your time, and I'm very grateful for it. So I guess just to wrap up, is there anything you wish I'd asked, or is there anything that you hoped I may have asked that I've neglected to ask?
No, I think we covered a lot, and I enjoyed this conversation, especially considering how difficult it was to get here. If the people only knew, the odds were against us. We had the cards stacked against us on this one. I don't know why, but it was very difficult. We had a lot of challenges, but we persevered. And I'm so glad that we did. I really enjoyed this conversation. So I appreciate you being patient with me. We tried to do this back before Christmas. So I'm grateful that I had a chance to meet with you first off, now kind of get to know you a little bit and have this conversation.
Oh, well, Joe, I'm really grateful to you, and that's really kind of you. It hasn't disappointed. It's been worth the wait, I'll say that.
So I appreciate that.
Delivered on the interview that almost never happened. But well, Joe, thank you so much for your time, and hopefully we can catch up again soon.
Absolutely. It was a blast. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.